Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 151 years ago today, on May 30th, 1868, 3 years after the end of the American Civil War and the spring of 1865, former Union General John A. Logan of the Grand Army of the Republic proclaimed the first Memorial Day to honor, quote, those who died in defense of their country. Despite other claims of its origin and bitter wrangling over its parochial insinuation to originally include Union dead only, Memorial Day was initially established as a single day of national mourning for American war dead from the Civil War through several successive wars, with a powerful element of inherent jingoism included, inspired by the inescapable reality that virtually everyone killed in the Civil War on either side, soldier or civilian, including slaves, was an American. Known initially as Decoration Day, because from then to now, mourners ritually decorate the graves of war dead with flowers, the single day of May 30th was traditionally commemorated annually as Memorial Day until 1971, when it was expanded into a three-day holiday with three other national holidays under the so-called Uniform Monday Holiday Act of 1968. Memorial Day was from 1971 on to be the last Monday in May each year. Consequently, both Memorial Day and Labor Day at the beginning of September act as bookends beginning and ending the annual summer silly season, which essentially makes a mockery of commemoration of the nation's war dead and its tribute to labor. Not only do unions not march on Labor Day anymore, unions have been eviscerated by corporate imperiosity. If the nation is to honor Memorial Day, it should do it for real instead of trivializing to little more than a facade of commercially subsidized partying that reduces it to something tawdry and comically manipulative. Memorial Day should return to a single day, May 30th, as it was traditionally, and be regarded in its original intent or discarded entirely. The same with Labor Day. Chambers of Commerce will yowl at any such return to basics, of course, and will publicly denounce it as obviously anti-business and palpably unpatriotic. Perhaps public celebrations are meant to go only skin deep, as insipid, officially sanctioned observations that profoundly affect us individually and as a nation, to superficially ease the itch of nagging deeper reflections that might be dangerous if truly aroused. On the essential premise of war and remembrance is balanced today's original date of Memorial Day. The raptorial, zealous fratricide that characterized the Civil War created, in the words of Frederick Low Olmsted, a republic of suffering. Drew Gilpin Faust, who wrote a recent book of the same title, This Republic of Suffering, explained that whatever else resulted of the Civil War, emancipation of slaves, reunification of the nation, for those who lived in and through the Civil War, quote, the texture of the experience, its warp and woof, was the overwhelming preeminence of death that would saturate everything else. At war's end, he wrote, this shared suffering would override persisting differences about the meaning of race, citizenship, and nationhood to establish sacrifice and its memorialization as the ground on which North and South would ultimately reunite. A poignant example of this shared feeling occurred at a 50th anniversary reunion of Gettysburg veterans in 1913. The reunion of the elderly blue and gray veterans on the hardest fought over and horrendously costly battlefield of their war was truly a reconciliation despite flares of animosity. A civil war is, after all, a family dispute, its antipathy almost eternal, its wounds long to heal. and often never. Reenactment of Pickett's charge, which was the final attack of the actual three-day battle by its last living survivors, was the most stirring moment of the reunion. The ancient rebels marched toward the old Yankees, waiting for them at the fabled stone wall on Cemetery Ridge, just as they had half a century earlier on July 3, 1863. The charging former Johnny Rebs broke into a ragged rebel yell as they came up to the wall they were unable to breach 50 years before. It was then, wrote an observer, that the Yankees, unable to restrain themselves longer, burst from behind the stone wall and flung themselves upon their former enemies, not in mortal combat, but reunited in brotherly love and affection. And that's a quote. Looking up old enemies is a cathartic act, quite often necessary for former combatants to develop a holistic perspective of a war they had engaged in. After all, in the final analysis, wrote a Vietnam veteran, no one really understands soldiers, be they friend or foe, as well as other soldiers. Reconciliation with former enemies, however, was not an act of reason Allied World War II paratroopers staged a 50th anniversary reenactment of their part in the Normandy D-Day operation by dropping into their old drop zones of 1944 on June 6, 1994. Germans were not invited to do D-Day celebrations, though whoever is still alive from that day, 75 years ago, next week, might be heartily welcome, whichever side they were on. The monument to the Vietnam War in Washington, D.C. is essentially what a war memorial should be, a measure of its cost rather than a celebration. In this instance, a tribute to the war's American combat dead by their surviving comrades. The wall of names of Americans killed in action in the decade-long war has had notable problems since its dedication on Armistice or Veterans Day 1982, such as initially neglecting women who were killed in the war, primarily as medical nurses tending the wounded, until the male vets at the wall's inauguration protested. "Where are the women?" they demanded. In order to truly represent the sum total of that war's human loss, a second wall should be constructed alongside the original wall, containing the names of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers who were killed in the war, which would prove extremely difficult because Americans were only interested in body counts, not names. Both walls should be surrounded by a huge circular monument listing the names of every Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Laotian, child, woman, and man, who were not combatants but were killed because they were the water the killer fish swam in, to paraphrase Mao Zedong's famous metaphor that the people were the sea to be fought over. Monstrous atrocities such as My Lai and the murders of civilians at Wei should be prominently displayed. Such monuments to the sinister and grotesque genocidal folly of war, particularly on a world oversupplied with nuclear weaponry, should be erected in every country involved in a war from this moment on to serve as warning that the only enemy is the malevolence we humans feel toward each other. 100 years ago today, on May 30th, 1919, President Thomas Woodrow Wilson, who was at Versailles, Paris, France, engaged in peace talks with other leaders of the victorious allies of the recently ended War to End All Wars, known also as World War I, left the morning session on Memorial Day to speak in eulogy at a cemetery the French had set outside Paris for interment of 1,500 American soldiers killed in the war. Local women decorated each grave with an American flag and wreath. Wilson, whose hair had turned white in the preceding year since sending American soldiers into the war in 1917, was visibly moved and gave what is considered one of the most moving speeches of his life. He wanted to put an end to war forever, but he failed, as everyone before and since who have had the same inspiration. Following is an excerpt of that speech a century ago today, essentially his core proposition of the necessity and perhaps the means of ending warfare permanently. And this is the excerpt of Wilson's speech. "It would be no profit to us to eulogize these illustrious dead if we did not take to heart the lesson which they have taught us. They are dead. They have done their utmost to show their devotion to a great cause, and they have left us to see to it that that cause shall not be betrayed, whether in war or in peace. It is our privilege and our high duty to consecrate ourselves afresh on a day like this to the objects for which they fought. It is not necessary that I should rehearse to you what those objects were. These men did not come across the sea merely to defeat Germany and associated powers in the war. They came to defeat forever the things for which the Central Powers stood, the sort of power they meant to assert in the world, the arrogant, selfish dominance which they meant to establish, and they came, moreover, to see to it that there should never be a war like this again. It is for us, particularly for us who are civilians, to use our proper weapons of counsel and agreement to see to it that there is never such a war again. The nation that should now fling out of this common concord of counsel would betray the human race. The thing that these men have left us, though they did not conceive it, is the great instrument of the League of Nations. You are aware, as I am aware, that the heirs of an older day are beginning to stir again, that the standards of an old order are trying to assert themselves again. There is here and there an attempt to insert into the council of statesmen the old reckonings of selfishness and bargaining and national advantage, which were the roots of this war, and any man who counsels these things advocates the renewal of the sacrifice which these men have made. For this is not the final battle for right. There will be another that will be final. The peoples of the world are awake, and the peoples of the world are in the saddle. Private councils of statesmen cannot and cannot hereafter determine that the destinies of nations. If we are not the servants of the opinion of mankind, we are of all men the littlest, the most contemptible, the least gifted with vision. If we do not know our age, we cannot accomplish our purpose, and this is an age that looks forward, not backward, which rejects the standards of national selfishness that once governed the councils of nations and demands that they shall give way to a new order of things in which the only questions will be, is it right? Is it just? Is it in the interest of mankind? This is a challenge that no previous generation ever dared to give ear to. So many things have happened, and they have happened so fast in the last 4 years since the war began, that I do not think many of us realize what it is that has happened. Think how impossible it would have been to get a body of responsible statesmen to seriously entertain the idea of an organization of a League of Nations 4 years ago. I think of the change that has taken place. I found the statesmen with whom I was to deal united in the idea that we must have a League of Nations, that we could not merely make a peace settlement and then leave it to make itself effectual, but that we must conceive some common organization by which we should give our common faith that this peace would be maintained and the conclusions at which we had arrived should be made as secure as the united councils of all the great nations that fought against Germany could make them. We have listened to the challenge, and that is the proof that there shall never be a war like this again." And that was Woodrow Wilson speaking in France on Memorial Day, May 30th, 1919, a century ago today. And now, by David von Driel, "It would be a tragedy to forget what the statistics of war represent. A single death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. This line, as brutal as it is true, is widely ascribed to Joseph Stalin, a man with terrible knowledge of death on every scale, from the single bullet to the brain of some former associate to the millions starved in Ukraine. But the general idea has been around for centuries. It is the switch in the human brain that makes war and other atrocities possible. Many years ago, a friend of mine lost his 10-year-old son in a fire. The news hit me like a physical blow, and decades later, I still recoil at the thought. Thinking about the firebombing of Tokyo does not make me feel 100,000 times worse. Such pain would be unbearable. Arguably, this is also a part of the distance that grows between combat soldiers and the civilians they serve. The soldier who is in the fight has a greater inkling of the humanity behind the statistics, a keener feeling for the individual lives, friends, and foes that add up one by one and 10 by 10 to 1,000, 1,000,000, 10,000,000. Nearly 7,000 U.S. Marines died in the 36-day battle for the 8 square miles of Iwo Jima. The statistician sees that number and calculates an average of nearly 200 per day and nearly 1,000 per square mile. The surviving veteran bears memories of screaming friends and spattered brains, week after week under the relentless sun, and where the history books say that 18,000 Japanese went into that little island and only 216 came off. Men who were sent to perform that fearsome reduction understand it not numerically, but viscerally. Memorial Day can be an opportunity to narrow, a bit, for a moment, the gap between specific and general, tragedy and statistic. The holiday arose from the trauma of the Civil War. It was a way of personalizing the enormous sacrifice. One day in the fullness of spring, the season of life and renewal, Americans made a ritual of decorating the graves and memorials of the war dead. The abstraction of war was tied down for a moment to the loss of real people with faces, names, and families. That war was followed by more wars, and the dead of the Civil War were joined by the dead from other generations. What was originally called Decoration Day became known as Memorial Day, and no matter how many beer bashes, clearance sales, or swimming pool openings are scheduled for that day, its reason for being is remembrance and reflection. The holiday is not necessarily anti-war, but if it stirs a pro-war feeling in your heart, you might not be doing it right. What Memorial Day asks is that we respect war enough to come to grips with its destructive power and steep price. What Memorial Day understands is that respecting war begins with mourning one life cut short, one tragedy, one grave. From there, we can try to imagine that pain times 1,000,000. We can try to transfuse life into the statistics. I used to drive frequently past Arlington National Cemetery. Sometimes I looked over to see 624 acres of rolling green countryside speckled with white headstones. But if I paused to imagine just one real person under one marker, the enormity would wash over me. We are the dead short days ago. We lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. A poem from World War I. If you don't have a national cemetery or battlefield close by, I suggest you use your computer to visit YouTube or Vimeo search for The Fallen of World War II by a man named Neil Halloran. This 18-minute cinematic data visualization, quote-unquote, brilliantly takes you from the tragedy of an individual killed in the war to the catastrophe of 60 million individuals gone. Even more brilliantly, Halloran illustrates the comparative peace of the years since 1945. That, too, is a statistic in need of new life. For it has become fashionable in many corners of the world for tough-talking leaders to question the value of alliances, treaties, and partnerships. These new nationalists rue the cost of the world order in terms of money and crimped sovereignty. They toy with breaking up the European Union, splintering NATO, blocking the arteries of trade that bind nations together. Such thinking is enabled by that switch in the brain that turns slaughter into data. anyone who has struggled to grasp the world as it was before these peacekeeping networks were woven, the global wars, the genocides, the deliberate famines and so-called revolutions that together decimated the early 20th century, cannot wish to return to the past. That would be a tragedy indeed. The dead have a lesson to teach us. Memorial Day is for listening and learning. And that was, it would be a tragedy to forget what the justice of war represent, by David Van Driel, and he wrote it for the Washington Post. This is Michael McCusker. On this day, May 30th, 1431, Joan of Arc was burned at the stake, which elicits a memory of an apothegm in an old coronet magazine of the 1950s from its famous last words department. A philosopher was on his deathbed, surrounded by family and friends. He lapsed into seeming unconsciousness. One of his sons felt his feet and said his father was still alive, because no one dies with warm feet. The philosopher awakened and said, "Joan of Arc did," and promptly died. Thanks and a tip of the hat, as comic artist Jimmy Hatlow used to say, to the engineer of this program, Dylan Hauser Schulk, for seamlessly salvaging a portion of last week's bluster that I badly trumped up, to use a flexible profanity for my ineptitude. My use today of war and remembrance, though not exclusive to him, is the title of a book by Herman Woke, who also wrote The Caine Mutiny. He died May 17th. At age 103. So, happy classical Memorial Day today. Use it or lose it. End all wars, or war just might end us all. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Useful cliches for a troubled future. Give me liberty or give me death, said Patrick Henry, who was literally born yesterday, May 29th, 1736. Thank you.